I don't know if you ever had a big yellow teapot in your house, but after nearly 40 years, ours is gone. And along with it, the furniture, the dog, and the people who lived in the teapot, although most of them had already disappeared over the years. The big yellow teapot was a plastic doll's house which was played with by our toddlers in the 1980s and, more recently, by our grandchildren. Last month, to make space in the attic, we said goodbye to the teapot and other toys that were no longer serviceable. But while sorting through a large box that was a veritable scrapyard of broken Zoids, non-transforming Transformers and arthritic Star Wars figures, I came across an intact toy from my own boyhood. A scale model Lancaster bomber, which by chance had been put in the box beside an Imperial Star Destroyer. World War II, parked next to a galaxy far, far away. The Airfix bomber, with its three swivelling gun turrets, brought me back to rainy afternoons spent at the kitchen table, gluing model parts and sometimes my fingers together. And then I remembered there was a box of my toys stored in the attic, and I just had to find it and look inside. One by one, familiar playthings came to light. Sword-wielding Roman legionaries and grenade-throwing American GIs. Dinky and corgi cars and trucks. A silver six-shooter still in its leather holster. And at the bottom of what had become like an archaeological dig, two artefacts from a 1950s childhood that need some explanation. One was a house-building set called Baco, from the word Bakelite. It came in a blue box with a picture of a boy and girl on the top admiring a realistic model house they've built using steel rods, red bricks and white bricks, green windows and doors, and bright red roofs. The instruction booklet calls it a never-failing diversion for boys and girls. No gender stereotyping there. But how about this for a selling point? Clean, hygienic, and easily sterilised by placing in boiling water or diluted antiseptic. These sets are ideal for children incapacitated by sickness or disease. It brought me back to polio outbreaks and school pals enduring long periods of recovery. Squashed under the Baco set was what looked for one unsettling moment like a furry piece of roadkill. With dawning recognition, I reached in and lifted it carefully out of the box. It was my Davy Crockett hat. In the mid-50s, an actor named Fess Parker played the American frontiersman and hero of the Alamo in a Disney television series. Accompanied by a catchy song, Davy, Davy Crockett, King of the Wild Frontier. A craze for all things Crockett, especially for the raccoon fur hat he was fond of wearing, swept America. In 1956, the fad arrived here with the release of a film version. Children as young as seven swapped their cowboy hats for coonskin caps, and some of us learned the song by heart. How long the craze lasted, I don't recall, but the relatively pristine condition of my silvery black fur hat suggests it didn't get much wear, which might have to do with my only abiding memory of sporting it in public. Confident that I was wearing the real thing, I went out to play with my pal, who lived a few doors down. He had just acquired a Davy Crockett hat too, and when I saw it, I realised with childish glee that it looked more like the fur of a marmalade tabby. "Your hat is a cat," I jeered. But he retaliated by pointing out that the tail of mine was plain and skinny, while the appendage on his was banded and bushy, just like the one that sprouted from the back of the King of the Wild Frontier's hat. I was mortified. I've since learned that some Davy Crockett hats were made of fake fur, but I can see that mine is definitely the skin of a so far unidentified mammal. Not that wearing an animal as a hat would have cost us kids a second thought. After all, I would often find myself at Sunday Mass being scrutinised by the glass eyes of some woman's fox fur stole. And I was well used to seeing my mother skinning rabbits for dinner. The look on my 8-year-old grandson's face as I told him this was priceless, he being a vegetarian to boot. Needless to say, when I asked him if he'd like to try on my Davy Crockett hat, he firmly declined. "I don't live in the wild frontier," he said. He had a point.
It was a balmy evening in Dublin, and we were all gathering in the foyer of the Project Arts Centre for the opening night of a production from the much-loved Fishamble Theatre Company. Theatre goers were still coming in, greeting each other, collecting tickets and going up the stairs to the auditorium on the first floor. I was near the ticket desk on my own. The great foyer was filled with noise, laughter and chatter. I stood to the side, watching it all unfold. I was there as a reporter in order to record the celebratory occasion when 14 new short plays would be performed. Later on, I'd interview some of the actors and the crew. Excitement was bubbling away in every group. It was then that I noticed a well-known actress coming out of the ladies. She stood there for a moment as the door swung shut behind her. She seemed preoccupied. And then the sheaf of papers she was carrying fell out of her hands. I saw her react, throwing up her hands in despair, and I heard her voice, filled with stress and annoyance, cut through the din. But no one was with her that I could see, and no one was paying her any heed. "Ah, I don't believe it. Ah, for God's sake," she cried. I could see her predicament. She was in meltdown. Her file of documents floated to the floor around her until they were strewn all about her at her feet. She looked down at them and wrung her hands. "Can somebody help me here? I can't believe this," she shrieked as she bent to pick them up. "I'm sick of it all." But still the noise around her continued, with groups of friends making their way up the metal stairway, oblivious to her state. No one was listening or helping her. That's when I decided to step in. I went to her and started picking up the papers, telling her it would be all right. She was so agitated that she ignored me, even when I tried to hand them to her. And she kept complaining, maniacally, at the top of her voice. I could feel the power of her emotion, of her annoyance. It came off her in waves, and it hit me like a force field of energy. It was as if I had stuck a scissors into a socket and got an electric shock. She was genuinely boiling. I felt so sorry for her that she was being ignored. Possibly people are playing it cool because she is famous, I thought to myself as I picked up the fallen sheets of paper. I tried to pass the pages to her, but she brushed right past me. She is so distracted and stressed, I reasoned to myself, that she is beyond even acknowledging my presence. Then, in her upset, she turned to the girl at the reception desk. This girl was answering a phone, explaining some detail to someone on the line. "Now, where's my pen?" the girl said, looking around for one. And quick as a flash, the actress I was trying to help said, "There's one in your hair." And only then did I begin to feel a little disorientated, and I had an inkling that some element of the moment was strange. It was then that I began to register the eyes of all those on the stairs bearing down on us, and I noticed how deadly quiet the place had grown, and I felt those spectators holding their breath, their eyes upon us, and I began to blush and to reverse away from the actress, realising that I had broken through a kind of barrier. That I had crossed over that imaginary threshold, the one that is created by actors when they step onto a stage. It is one we are not supposed to transgress. But But that evening, there were no footlights to warn me that this was a performance. There was no proper stage and no seated audience. We were still in the foyer when I had walked over towards her. It was a strange feeling to cross the line that separates reality from illusion. For a few moments, I had left the real world and tasted the world of make-believe and illusion. Later, the actress and I laughed about it. The short play, written by Dawn Bradfield, which had kick-started the evening, was deemed a hit, and the lead actress, Geraldine Plunkett, was applauded for her powerful performance.
When I was looking for somewhere to live in Amsterdam in the 1980s, an artist friend offered me her studio in a decrepit building in the inner city. My friend had just married a wealthy publisher and was moving to a stately mansion on one of the main canals. Her studio was in a rough area with a lot of squats and drug addicts. The door to the studio was steel-plated with drop locks and heavy bolts. The house directly opposite was occupied by a gang of German drug dealers who late at night enthusiastically sang Nazi drinking songs. Next door, a homely Dutch lady plied her ancient trade. On another corner, a gaggle of students of early music banged away all day at their harpsichords in an attempt to replicate the authentic Baroque sounds. It was a lively neighbourhood. When I moved in, there was little or no furniture, but my friend had left behind a large, battered 1950s Philips radio, which I was glad to have. It had a crystal clear sound, but the dial was broken, so that it was stuck on one station. Luckily, it was probably the best station in the world, the BBC World Service. As we didn't have a television, and wouldn't have one for many years, the radio would become our principal source of news and information. I soon became addicted to it. The highlights were many. Edward Greenfield's Classical Record Review was a musical education in itself, as he joyfully and expertly compared historic recordings of the operatic greats. Alistair Cook's Letters from America were always full of astonishing stories, riveting in their compression and elegance. Then there was Derek Malcolm, the Eton schoolboy turned steeplechase jockey, who became the first racing correspondent for The Guardian and eventually a legendary film critic. In his slightly lisping accent, he would enthuse about the latest films by Herzog, Godard, Bergman and Fassbinder. In addition, there were knowledgeable local correspondents from places I had never even heard of. But above all, I became an obsessive listener to the news bulletins on the hour. Thoughtful, in-depth analysis, and not at all Eurocentric, with English news relegated to a minor position. And the first thing I would hear when I woke in the mornings and turned on the radio were the stirring tones of the tune Lily Bolero, which preceded the news. The tune always sounded vaguely Irish to me, a kind of a jig, and it worked on me like Pavlov's dog, snapping me awake and instantly ready to digest the happenings in the world from the comfort of my bed. Then one day, snuffling around an antiquarian bookshop, I came across an early edition of Percy's Relics of Ancient English Poetry, a remarkable collection of old English songs and poems published in the 18th century. I took it home and devoured it. To my delight, I saw that it included the original text of the song Lily Bolero. But when I read it, I got a bit of a shock. I had presumed the tune was old, but what I hadn't realised was that it was a piece of anti-Irish propaganda dating from the Williamite Wars, which, it was claimed at the time, had sung James II out of three kingdoms. The song is written in the voice of an Irish Catholic foot soldier and opens with the words, "Ho, Brother Tighe doth hear the decree, we shall have a new deputy, Lily Bolero Bullen Alaw." The song goes on to promise to cut every Englishman's throat and to burn all heretics, i.e. Protestants. It became one of the most popular songs of its day, sung by the Williamites going into battle against the Irish Jacobites. Scholars of Irish have claimed that the nonsense refrain Lily Bolero, Bullen Allah, is a garbled version of a real Irish sentence, which prophesies an Irish victory. Apparently, the 17th century Irish believed fervently in all kinds of prophecies, and they were being mocked for this. I put the book aside and pondered my next move. This was clearly a politically incorrect, racist and sectarian work of art, arising out of a war whose consequences were still with us, as I heard daily on the radio news. And yet, the same could be said of so many other works, from Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice to W.G. Griffith's Birth of a Nation, not to mention The Adventures of Tom Sawyer. I was faced with a dilemma. But as the dial was broken, I had little choice. And so, the now ambiguous and politically charged strains of Lily Bolero would ease my passage from sleep into wakefulness for many years to come.
On a recent holiday in the United States, I visited a 19th century house in Hartford, Connecticut. The guide talked about the owner of this lavish home, one Sam Clemens, an author, inventor and family man. Our guide also mentioned that on a previous tour, a visitor had remarked, "Who is this guy Sam you keep mentioning? I thought we were in Mark Twain's house." Samuel Langhorne Clemens was born in Missouri in 1835. But when he started writing in earnest in his 30s, he adopted the pseudonym Mark Twain. Clemens used different names before deciding on Mark Twain. He signed imaginative sketches as Josh and as Thomas Jefferson Snodgrass for a series of humorous letters. He maintained that his primary pen name came from his years working on Mississippi riverboats. Twain is an archaic term for two, as in the phrase, "never the twain shall meet," and Sam Clemens had heard boatmen on the river shout, "Mark Twain," meaning that the depth of the river was 2 fathoms and therefore safe to pass. As I walked around the Mark Twain house, admiring the hand-stenciled wood panelling, embossed wallpaper and carved wooden furniture in this magnificent Victorian Gothic Revival building, I mused that the income of a writer in 19th century America must have been a good one. I was impressed, until the guide told us that the house had been built before Clemens had made any money from his books, but rather had been supported by his wife Olivia's inheritance. So he had married money. The Clemens family moved into the home in 1874 after its completion. They imported furniture from France, which was fashionable at the time, and much of the interior was decorated in a way that would impress friends. Indeed, among their acquaintances were several authors of note, such as their neighbour Harriet Beecher Stowe and President Ulysses Grant, with whom Sam collaborated in publishing a memoir. The top floor was the billiards room and Sam's private study, where he would write late at night. The room was strictly off-limits to all but the cleaning staff. It was also used for entertaining male guests with cigars and alcohol. Mrs. Clemens tutored their 3 daughters in a room on the second floor before they would move on to high school in the community. The girls' father, now steadily becoming a well-known author, would play with them in the plant-filled conservatory, pretending to be an elephant in an imaginary safari. Clemens at this stage was engrossed in writing his adventure stories, set along the Mississippi. And it would appear that he had a sense of mischievousness similar to his characters. Sam had grown up in Hannibal, Missouri, the town that would provide the inspiration for St. Petersburg in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. The success of Tom Sawyer inspired him to renovate the house, and he employed the well-known New York designer Lewis Tiffany to supervise the interior decoration. He was also fascinated with new technologies, leading to the installation of an early telephone. All would seem to have been going well for the Clemens, with Sam a successful author, Olivia a wealthy woman, and the 3 girls growing up happy and well-educated. but darker times were ahead. Sam, a former printer, invested in the development of a typesetting machine, which was intended to make him a fortune, while advancing the lot of printers in America. The machine, called a Page Compositor, after its inventor, James Page, was complex and expensive, and as an invention was a complete failure, leading to Sam's bankruptcy. Meanwhile, the loves of his life succumbed to illness. First his eldest, Susie, died, then his beloved wife, Olivia, and some years later, his youngest, Jean, leaving Sam with his only surviving daughter, Clara. Sam Clemens, a.k.a. Mark Twain, died in 1910, having declared himself bankrupt several years earlier. I left the house in Hartford with the thought of how one's life's fortunes can rise and fall like a river. A week later, I was in St. Genevieve, Missouri. Standing on the bank of the Mississippi, looking across at Illinois, I wondered how I could have the experience of travelling on the river when I didn't have any business on the other side. The ferryman noticed my curiosity. "I'll take you across for $2, he shouted. In the ferry cabin, I asked him about Twain's and Mark's. "You know, this thing helps me calculate everything," he said, pointing to the electronic controls on his John Deere boat. "I know river's going to rise 6 feet in the next 6 hours." Now, wouldn't Sam Clemens just love this invention?
I turned on the radio one evening recently to hear Joni Mitchell singing about the last time she saw Richard in Detroit in 68. And it reminded me of the first time I saw Richard. It was in Limerick in September 66. I was halfway down the main stairs in St. Clement's College and he was coming through the front doorway with his parents. He was a new arrival and I was a second year man of the world. And that was the beginning of a friendship that still follows its own heartbeat more than 50 years later. In the decades that followed, we travelled through secondary school and college together. On days when we might have been more or less productively employed at study, we played World Cup matches on the back pitch at Belfield. We discussed the possibility of living a hippie life on one of the Blasket Islands, but never did. We shared work and lodgings in London in the burning summers of 1975 and 1976. We haunted the Royal Court Theatre, just across the road from our place of employment. We read the same books and spent long nights discussing the meanings of poems and the directions of our lives. Our friendship grew and deepened, and our shared love of literature and theatre kept it singing. And if you asked me now, more than 50 years into that friendship, what it is I best remember of the years gone by, I'd go back to a winter night at the end of January 1972. Paul Simon had just released his album Paul Simon, and Richard and myself had spent the evening in the sitting room of my parents' house in Castledermot, listening and re-listening to the tracks. From Mother and Child Reunion, through Everything Put Together Falls Apart, to the closing notes of Congratulations. No line went without analysis, and no song was heard simply for its melody. The love of words that had drawn us together was at the heart of the things we talked about as the LP spun on the turntable. Eventually, late in the evening, my parents let it be known that they might just like to watch some programme or other on TV. And Richard and I pulled on our jackets and headed out into the night. Castledermot in 1972 did not possess a coffee shop. It didn't even lay claim to a chip shop. So we set off walking and did the circle that took us out the pitch dark Barrack Road, past the towering shadow of Prumplestown Mill, and back in the Carlow Road. A walk of 4 or 5 miles. It was late, well after midnight, when we ambled down Barn Hill, past the frozen greens of the Pitch and Putt Club. And that was when we had the idea.
We would attempt to walk from one end of the village, from Farrelly's bicycle shop, to Behan's garage at the other end, but without stepping off the white lines, broken and unbroken, that ran along the middle of what was then the main Dublin to Waterford road. If a car or lorry disturbed us, then the adventure would be deemed a failure. If we made it, it would be a night to remember. And so we walked, crossing the Lure Bridge, past the ruined abbey and the closed doors of the Castle Cinema, beneath the shadow of Joan of Arc's statue in Aylmer's garden, by the National Schools with the immense shadow of the Round Tower behind them, across the square and on, passing Hennessy's garage and the moonlit remnants of the plague hospital, until finally the white line disappeared where the road passed Behan's garage and stretched away by the cottages at Skenagon, and on into the buttermilk distance of open countryside. We had done it. Not a solitary car had disturbed our walk. Not a lorry or van had interrupted our conversation. We had, in the space of half an hour, passed 1,000 years of history and a lifetime of analysis. We had settled on an interpretation of mother and child reunion. We had discussed the irony in congratulations. And we had agreed that peace, like a river, had something magical about it. Something that reflected the wonder and delight of our little voyage along the narrow white line, in the middle of a deserted but moonlit road, in a tiny Kildare village. Since that night, our lives have broken in different directions. Sometimes a year passes between meetings, but all I have to do is slip that Paul Simon album into the CD player, skip to track 7, and I'm back on the moon-drenched road. The night is still. The stars are frozen solid against the sky. The ghosts of centuries past have stepped away from the windows of empty buildings. And we are walking, Richard and myself, lost in conversation, adrift in the moment. And I recognise again, and am reminded, if I need reminding, of the true and simple nature of our friendship.
On this morning's collection of new and archive writing, we heard Attic Archaeology by Pat Dunn, Caught in the Limelight by Catherine Foley, Lily Bolero by Michael O'Loughlin, The Adventures of Mark Twain by Nulla Groen, and The Nature of Friendship by John McKenna. The first piece of music on this morning's Sunday Miscellany was The Ballad of Davy Crockett, performed by Fez Parker. That was followed by Sunburst by Andrew York, performed on guitar by John Williams. Then we heard Lily Bolero, played by the Central Band of the RAF. And finally, the last piece of music was The Boatman's Dance by Mick Maloney.